Welcome to the second Eve Media Roundtable. For tonight, I am your moderator and I'm Wiggles from Eve Radio. This is a joint effort by everyone who's in attendance tonight, and this project is to bring the media together from all across Eve Online to talk about topics in a moderated format. Tonight's topic is NullSec changes, and each participant will have 2 minutes to give an answer on the question at hand, and at the end of each, once we've had all the participants talk, we'll have an open discussion period of 5 to 10 minutes. Tonight's participants in no particular order. We have Kyle Apathosis, and I've spelled it wrong again, from themitani.com. Alexia Vicard from Declarations of War podcast.
Howdy.
Lockfox from the Eve Prosper Market Show.
Thanks again.
We have Dirk McGurk from Eve Radio. And we have Connell Tara from the Fly Reckless podcast.
Ew.
And we have Shadow and Light from the Legacy of a Capsuleer podcast.
Gentlemen and ladies.
Gentlemen and ladies, yes. So, as I said, this is a moderated format, and we will be cracking on with the first question. The first question, before we get into the meat and bones of it, is number one. Before we discuss the major changes, let's begin with why do players choose to live in NullSec? Again, we'll go in the list. So, Kyle, if you want to have your thoughts on that, please.
Absolutely. To be honest, I thought this was one of the trickiest questions to actually look at in the entire list, primarily because it really depends on if you're talking about NPC NullSec or Sov Null, and both of those groups have very different reasons for living in NullSec. Sov Null holders will give you a whole variety of different reasons surrounding logistics, super capita building, rallying around the flag. NPC NullSec guys are always talking about elite PvP and whatnot, but if I had to give a condensed one-sentence answer, I would say that NullSec represents by far the best way to make the space feel like it's your own, to feel like you have a sense of control and agency over what's going on, whether you're an NPC Null or Sov Null, and it's this that draws players out to NullSec from LowSec and HighSec.
Okay. Alex, yeah, for you as well, why do we discuss, why do people choose to live in NullSec?
I think it has to be the level of control. I think a lot of people come to EVE Online for the player interaction, the fact that players can make everything in the game, everything's destroyed by players. There are a lot of people that like the lore of EVE that CCP creates, but I think a lot more people join the game because they hear about the metagame and they hear about all this crazy stuff that's going on, all the neat things that players are inventing, coming up with, and screwing each other over with in news and in blogs. I think that's where, more than any other place, 00 kind of embodies that spirit, where it's the most rules free, or rather player set rules place. There's everything has to be built by you, basically, and you set the rules, you set your friendships, and it's all about, you know, living off the sweat of your back and how hard you can fight and how hard you can do intel and all that kind of thing. And there's no real safety net aside from NPC 00. So that's what I think that represents to a lot of people. And that's why I think it's attractive to them.
Okay. Lockfox?
I have to agree with Alex on a lot of the points. It's really the Wild West frontier. So if you want to go do the biggest, baddest stuff, the NullSec is really the place to go do it. It's also one of the places where the risk and reward functionality is the highest, so you have supposedly the highest risk, and you get the greatest reward, so that ends up being a goal for a lot of players to go mining, or ratting, or PvPing, or whatever it is. It's considered an endgame. I hate using the word endgame for EVE, but it's a big pillar of high activity kind of stuff. So that's what NullSec is for.
Okay, Dirk?
Yeah, I mean, I look at this entirely what we're talking about here, and kind of why when I came up with, you know, the questions, I put this in first, because I thought it's probably best to get a kind of general understanding of well, why do people even bother to live there, and then kind of what do the changes mean to people. I mean, having lived in NullSec, you know, since, you know, I don't know, after the first month I started playing the game in 2008, I know I first went out there because it was this place out beyond the reaches of Empire, right? You know, there was this riskiness to it. But really, for me as a player, it was about the economic opportunity, that I thought that there was this place that it was higher risk and therefore my economic opportunities would be bigger. And I think that for individual players, that probably does kind of, you know, come into play. But bigger than that, I think that because it, you know, because it is this open place, right, that players can take and claim sovereignty. And again, I'm not talking about NPC null here. There's that sense of ownership, and ownership is something that I think that people can kind of buy into. And around that is even the larger thing of a sense of community, that there is this community that builds up around, hey, we own this. This is ours. We work together in order to, you know, farm the fields or defend the bastions or whatever. I mean, ultimately, Nullsec's the place where, you know, you and your mates kind of, you know, have the opportunity to build something that the developers didn't just hand you. High sec, low sec, these things are already constructs that are there. They are developed. But everything about Nullsec, you know, given the tools that they give us, is built by the players.
Okay, Colonel Tara from Fly Reckless.
I think the big thing with Null, that really, like, why people go there, what sets it different from anything else, and I think Dirk was completely on the ball with this, is Nullsec is the part of the game where community really makes the difference. When you look into Null, it's the story of empires, it's the story of groups, it's the story of teamwork, it's the story of activity. It's us versus them, those guys versus those guys, honorable third party, the ambushes, the battles, the big stuff that only really comes into effect because CCP has given us a tool which lets us get that scale of gameplay. If you look at almost any other MMO, I mean, it's staggering, like, something like PlanetSide talks about having 2,000 players on a single server. Yeah, cool. But there's no permanence there. And that's really what Nullsec is about. It's about putting your stamp on something. It's a constantly evolving story. And there's really no other parts of the game, I mean, that really does that. Not even Wormhole Space, where I hang out. There's no real permanence to that. But you stake a claim in Null, you sweep 50 systems, you get your name on the map, you're part of the history. And there's really no other part of you that does that.
Okay, and the final comment for this section will be Shadow from Legacy of Capsulea.
I respect my distinguished gentleman's opinion, and I agree with them for the most part, but I feel they're missing some of the Pavlovian desires for people to move into Nullsec. You have entities who are centered around things such as moon production and stations, building supers and titans in 00. I would agree they also have more control over the environment. They have the ability to anchor bubbles and have PvP that is without the same negatives as you have in high sec and low sec. But I think really the main motivator for a lot of these entities is to center around organizations who are motivated and people who are motivated to lead them while being able to engage in content that is a little bit more diverse and separated from as many people as you find in high sec. I think you should look at motivators such as income and their ability to live in a quieter section of space. I think if Nullsec was as busy as high sec, you might not see the diversity as you see now.
Okay. We're going to have a 5-minute open discussion now on why people live in Nullsec. So we'll open it up to the floor and, well, who wants to head off the first part of this discussion?
I'll just jump in. Look, I think, you know, I think a lot of people were kind of saying, you know, many of the same things. I mean, it's no real, you know, surprise that, you know, we talk about things like community and, you know, groups working together, right? I mean, because it really is the only way to truly succeed in the sovereignty Nullsec system. I mean, I don't know. What does everybody else think in terms of is Nullsec the biggest true sandbox part of the game?
Yeah, on the large scale, certainly. On the small scale, less so. One of the big problems with NullSec as it currently exists is it doesn't really cater for the smaller groups, the 10 to 20 guys. You kind of need to be pegged onto something bigger. 10 to 20 guys, you probably be able to achieve more personally if you're somewhere like low or if you're in wormhole space. But if you've got like the numbers to really make an impact, NullSec just opens up massively. And I think that's the big difference.
I think that's really the key point here is it's a numbers game when you really start talking about it. And if you want to be in the making something bigger, being a bigger part of something, like you don't have the CFC Conquer Fountain without 4,000 people ready to move that thing forward. You don't have any of these regions under control with, you know, just a dozen guys. You have hundreds or thousands of them, and that can be a driving factor. That can be a positive for a lot of players, and it can just as much be a negative for the kind of people who want to ruggedly cut out on their own. It can be just a little bit stifling, but the numbers are really the key factor, I think, when it comes to talking about how much NullSec, who goes to NullSec, and why you would drive the entire gameplay.
I gotta step in here. I think it's a bit of a misnomer to say that NullSec is only for people with large numbers. My corp and I, regardless of what alliance we've been in, we've been making meals out of NullSec entities for a long time, and we've never had more than, certainly never had more than 100 people in my corp. Don't think we've ever had more than 200 people in any alliance that we've been in. And have done just fine. Now, people would probably debate with you the level of relevance we've had to this kind of thing, but I mean, we've taken stations, for instance, certainly helped turn wars one way or the other during the course of EVE's history. I mean, it's definitely possible if you're good enough and you understand how the game works and you understand where small numbers can have an impact, if you focus on that area of impact, you can really make a difference, and people will step up and take notice.
The only thing does depend too on. Sorry about that. I was just gonna say it really does depend too on what exactly the scale you're talking about is. I mean, I don't think anybody in this room denies that smaller groups like your own make a huge difference, especially on the scale of regional fights. But when people talk about relevance, they so often what's the phraseology? Something along the lines of miss the details for the big picture, I suppose. They focus on the grand sweeping metagame, the fights that span across entire regions, or see N3 and the CFC coming together to duke it out, and they miss the fact that there is another level of relevance, and that is on the local regional conflict, that sometimes that's all people ever really are interested in.
I mean, as someone who is like very much the outsider when it comes to the NullSec stuff, again, I'm a worm holder. I'm those strange hobos that sit with their shotguns on the porch. NullSec has always been sort of a problem for us as a nebulous thing, because there's been times where we've considered, do we want to like go out into Null and maybe put up our flag there? But when we're talking about smaller groups, there is a lower level where you kind of need to start with when it comes to NullSec kind of combat. I mean, 50 to 60 guys, like, a line and active, that would be ideal for it. But if you're like a group like us, for example, where we're talking maybe 20 to 30 when we have every single time zone online at the one time, it becomes a lot more difficult for us to actually sort of fiddle in the current system. You know, when it's structure grinds and so on and so forth. I mean, we can harass, we can annoy, we can poke, but there's not much else we can do at the moment. Of course, what we're talking about might change that.
Agreed.
Okay, I think we're good to move on. We've just come up to the 5 minutes on that one, so we'll move to the second question, unless there's anyone else wants to bring very quickly on this topic up, on that question.
On the second question?
We'll move to the second question. Okay, the second question is as follows. What are your thoughts on the proposed Sovereignty Warfare capture mechanics? Again, we'll go in the same order as before. So, Kyle, what are your thoughts on that?
When I first saw them rolling out with the deck blogs, I think that was, what, about a month and a half ago now at most, I was incredibly impressed. I've become perhaps a little bit jaded with it over the course of the last few weeks, but at the same time, it seems to me that what they're overall attempting to accomplish here is twofold. One, they're trying to make the system more dynamic by drastically speeding up the process which you use to take soft. Now, I know you still have the 48-hour wait timers and all that good stuff, but No longer is there an arbitrarily high, you must grind through this many EHP before you can take this structure barrier. And that holds doubly true when we're talking about the entry barrier into Sov, as we touched on in the open discussion of the last question. It's very hard for smaller corps to make an impact, even if they're outstanding at PvP, because over the last 6 years, however long it's been since Dominion Sov rolled out, that many established alliances have had their chance to sit and grind and build up their super capital force. The entry barrier to owning Sov has become extraordinarily high, and as far as I'm concerned, these changes are a good way to level the playing field without necessarily, quote-unquote, nerfing coalitions, as some people have professed. So overall, pretty damn impressed, actually.
Okay, next up, Alex from Declarations of War.
I like him. I think it's definitely a step up from what we've got. I could see my corp doing it, which is cool. I could see how large alliances could take entire regions faster if they're not defended, which is great. I think it gives people that can defend some options to at least slow down that kind of attack, which is also great. I'm a little bit worried about the time zone window mechanic, kind of freezing out portions of NullSec. So if you have, say, an Australian or Russian alliance that takes a certain system, and you're basically screwing anyone that is not also an Australian or Russian alliance from even challenging for it, I think there needs to be some work there to provide more opportunities for time zone play. But in terms of like the actual putting a system into reinforced and then fighting over it or not fighting over it, I think it's actually pretty cool.
Okay, and next is Lockfox from the Eve Market Prosper Show.
I'm going to echo a lot of what has been said and probably will be said, is that I believe that the changes on the net are good. The goal that people should keep in mind is that Dominion Sov has really been about hit points, and that's where a lot of the troubles we've seen, a lot of the symptoms of the sort of crummy gameplay we've seen over the last couple of years, especially in the last 6 or 8 months, that have come out, and people are just sort of not really playing the Sov game. I think this is a great step in that direction. Now, the minutiae of actually utilizing the systems, I'm still a little fuzzy on. I'm still a little wavering about, how much of the Entosis do we really care about? I mean, I like that there isn't so much an N+1 problem anymore, but now we start talking about very strange metas that you have to bring in your fleet to attack or defend. There's a lot of the time zone stuff gets a little under my skin, but I have some faith on that front, not that we've seen much news about that yet. So overall, I'm happy. It's been a long time since I've been in Sov War, though, so I'm like the last person to really weigh in with a meaningful opinion here.
Okay, and next on the list is Dirk from EVE Radio.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the mechanics are different, and perhaps different is all, or it is not all, but what we kind of need right now. We need a change. It's been a number of years now that we've been operating under this other system, and everything is built up around it to where we have basically, you know, min-maxed this thing to death. So a change might be good just for a change's sake in that regard. Whether or not it changes much of anything, you know, in the long run is a different question. You know, people talk about the grind, but a grind is a grind, whether it's hit points or command nodes. After you've done it 100 times, it all gets pretty grindy. Empires as we know them, I think, are going to contract in terms of kind of, you know, the reach that they have right now. But I don't think that the empires themselves are very likely to change. This system kind of, you know, plays as much into the hands of the big, well-organized alliances and coalitions, you know, as does the current hit point mechanic. You know, I don't think there's anything that's going to, you know, necessarily, you know, tell people, oh, hey, go be smaller. Not when what you're talking about is, well, if somebody comes and attacks, you're going to have these nodes spread across, you know, a constellation, and you're now going to have to find a way of, you know, capturing enough flags in the allotted time to be able to win. I think that it will add to some of the smaller scale conflict. Smaller entities will be able to do things that they haven't been able to do in the past, which is basically come in and try and, if nothing else, instigate annoyance, low yield attacks. In the long run, I think it's better than what we have now, but only because we've had what we've had now for so long.
Okay.
No, I disagree there a little bit.
Save that, Alec. Save it.
Save that.
Save it
okay.
up.
Okay.
Bottle it up. Next on the list is Connell from Fly Reckless.
When I first read these changes, and if we had done this literally after the changes come out, the 2 minutes of me talking would have just been me cackling nonstop, relentlessly. Now I've had a bit more time to sort of digest and fiddle and theory craft and things, I'm really, really positive about this. The reason I like this idea is it's shifting... how can I describe it? It's not about having all your guys in one place anymore. I mean, you can do that, but it's going to hurt. It's going to encourage people to genuinely think about things. The meta is going to shift. It's not going to be stack all your guys on one massive pillar of death, run it through the enemy team. No, you're going to have to think about attacking, counterattacking. Which points do you take? Which points do you defend? Which gates do you camp? Do you control this regional gate? Do you need to control this regional gate? Are you going to Black Ops people behind the enemy positions in order to harass their sites? Are you going to have fast groups which just harass the enemy while they're trying to cap? Or are you going to have slow groups which then pound them into oblivion? There's so many different ways you're going to be able to approach this that you're going to end up with a much, much more interesting and hopefully much, much more long-lived style of gameplay. There were some concerns that came out, obviously. I mean, we're EVE players. If we don't throw up our hands and declare the apocalypse with every single minor change, we wouldn't be EVE players. But a lot of what I'm seeing so far is the little changes, little tweaks are working relatively well. Only thing I'm a little iffy about is the time zone thing, but I can see the logic for it. I mean, hopefully we'll see a better fix for that. But, I mean, there's just so many ways for different talents to emerge in this kind of thing. And it's going to give us wormholers a whole new way to fuck with people. It's magnificent. I love it.
Okay, and finally for this part, Shadow and Light.
You know, my main concern with the new sovereignty system has been how will smaller entities be able to survive in the new system, and I don't feel like they will have as strong of a position as people tend to think they will. I think instead of having renters or having large coalitions hold tons of space, those coalitions might retract their holdings, but I still think the end result will end up being a sort of ransoming of these smaller groups from the larger coalitions. And for people who say that the objectives have changed, you go from having to capture a station or kill a TCU or grind down structures, the end result of all of those real battles was, can you get a hand on and kill the enemy fleet? And I still think even with this current structure system or his current sovereignty system, the real objective for the aggressor is going to be to bait out and put a killing blow on the hostile fleet. And I don't feel like these mechanics really give the smaller group a chance to hold space. They might be able to take it, but I think they'll end up being ransomed and baited out to try to defend their space in order for this coalition or whoever is attacking to move on.
Okay, now we'll open this up to a 5-minute open discussion, and I believe, Alex, you had something to say.
Yeah, a grind is a grind, sure, but we're going from a grind which, you know, if you had, say, 20 people, knowing from having done this with experience, and you want to, say, repair a station that's been reinforced by a very large Russian coalition a couple hours before, you know, it might take you 5, 6, 7 hours on op to do that. On the other hand, you could have one person do it if they don't show up. Like, the amount of man hours you're saving under this new system is just massive. So, yes, it's going to be a grind, just like making Iskus a grind, just like any repetitive task is a grind, yes. But to compare the two, I think, is really missing the point, and it's just how much time this will save us in terms of the unfun parts of EVE. The fun part is the fighting. If they show up, then yeah, you're going to have an op on your hands. But if they don't show up, it's going to be 30, 60 minutes and you're done. You can go do something else. You can go roam. You can go gate camp. You can go play League if you want to. But you don't have to sit there watching the station's gray bar slowly turn red with 20 to 25 of your other friends night after night until you just want to stop playing the game entirely.
Well, and that's the, I think that's the most critical point here, is that we're talking about time, is that previously under the old system, we talked about hit points, and yes, hit points require a scaling of fleet so that you basically get a straight N reduction by every person you add into the fleet, right? But under this system, we're talking about an op requires a certain amount of time, and you can bring 10 people, you can bring 1,000 people, but it's still going to take the same units of time. And I think that's really the most powerful balance tool that CCP has in their arsenal. It has to do with the actual time required, because every other system that talks about money or number of like man hours or any of that other kind of stuff can be gamed, right? If we just have, if supers are supposed to be rare because they're expensive, but we've proven that they're not rare because you can make them, you could increase the price by 10x and you'd still see a large number of supers. You'd still see people coming together. You'd see less, but it's not a bar that cannot be overcome. If the timer takes 30 minutes and it doesn't matter how many people you bring, then the timer takes 30 minutes.
And what I do, you know, what I do definitely like about this new system is we're going from, you know, Dominion sovereignty, which I think was very heavily weighted towards centralized strategic planning, to much more consideration towards the tactical side of how am I going to either defend or attack. You know, especially in the second stage scenarios, you know, when you know, do I take my entire force and go to this one place and try and, you know, get it? Or do I split my force? Or do I think the other guy is going to split his force and therefore this is what I'm going to, you know, I think there's going to be much more tactical decision making involved with this, which I think is good, besides just spreading things out a little bit more so that we don't, you know, necessarily, you know, get to those lag fest type battles where it's like, you know, just this one big climactic battle. And then everything after that is, well, that's the same thing that's going to happen the next time.
Yeah, see, that's the, obviously I just ranted out there, but that's what's really exciting me about this. And to be honest, the organized coalitions and alliances things are definitely going to prosper under this system because they're able to organize, but it's going to be the groups who can have like even two or three or even, you know, four or five guys who can take a smaller sub-fleet out from the main group, go off and do their assigned tasks. The ability to delegate and split your force up is going to be a hugely important thing. Individual pilot skill is going to become a lot more important than turning up to the tie-dye F1. There's still going to be some of that, but if one, you turn up on the site with, say, battleships, the R guy turns up with hacks, they're able to outmaneuver you, you lose, that's fine. But if they've sent their entire fleet to deal with you, you've got four other groups that are taking points elsewhere. I mean, that's the real opportunity, I think, that's really coming out of this new system.
And it creates a pretty nice, don't know precisely what the word I'm looking for here is, but it creates a really nice system wherein you can no longer, especially with some of the more massive alliances in EVE, wait until a timer comes out of reinforced and then just descend upon them with your finger of God blob of 120 smart bombing aeons and expect to immediately blow up the fleet off grid, blap the SBU, whatever. It's no longer going to work like that. You can't expect the really slow finger of God to win all fights, which I very much appreciate because that's boring as hell.
And of course, the other big thing that's really going to come in with this new system is going to be the importance of gate control. I mean, right now, it is important. I mean, controlling the entrance to a system makes a big difference. But when you need fleets to maneuver throughout a constellation constantly to get these new points, the group who has a group of bubblers who are ready and able to get in the way and slow the other team down is going to have a huge advantage. There's all these little things that are becoming much more relevant. Ships which are only niche use suddenly become a lot more powerful.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the Phoebe changes, the force projection, you know, the travel changes certainly come into play here, right? Because without those, you could theoretically skip those gates and you just bounce, you know, Sino to Sino to Sino, you know, around there, right? You know, so I mean, that definitely plays into all of this.
Yeah, right now within your Phoebe changes, if you want to commit your entire capital force to defend a single capture node, that's all well and good, but you can't Sino your capital force to the next node for another 5 minutes after that. You can't teleport at will anymore.
I mean, one of the things that does concern me a little bit is that, you know, again, you know, taking Sov away, causing somebody to lose Sov is one thing. Being able to hold is another. And I am a little bit concerned that what we end up with is, instead of, you know, whatever you want to call it, the big blue donut or these large swaths of blue or red space, that, you know, we end up with empty space rather than unused claim space. But either way, it's still a system that, you know what, nobody can hold and nobody can, you know, well, nobody can hold. I mean, whether it be the Empire where it's out on their fringe, or whether it be the small guy who tries to hold it, but somebody comes in and stomps their stuff in.
Yeah, God forbid somebody, especially if these new structures are going to be expensive, God forbid you place one of these new structures or you build a station in one of these systems and you're not a part of a large block. I think you're in a lot of trouble.
I mean, to an extent, I can see where you're coming from, but at the same time, like, on a hypothetical scenario that, I don't know, the CFC decided that somewhere in, I don't know, somewhere in the far southeast, let's just Sino in, drop all their Sov. That's great and all. I'm sure we could accomplish that, but at the same time, it doesn't really do us much of any good, because as soon as we go home, unless we decide, okay, the entirety of the CFC is living in Wicked Creek now, then as soon as we turn around and go home, they're going to be able to take that Sov right back within a matter of days. So you could get into that, but it's going to be a pointless push and pull to try to keep taking Sov unless you want it.
I would disagree because I think the major issue that we see where smaller groups aren't able to gain a foothold is because they haven't had the time or the space to build up a Super or Titan fleet. Now, let's pretend maybe in the future, Supers and Titans won't be a thing anymore. Maybe you won't need them to be a contender in 0-0. Maybe it'll just be bodies. You'll just need human beings inside of frigates to contend sovereignty, and you won't see Supers and Titans a year from now. I highly doubt that'll happen, but we'll see. That's one of the biggest issues. I think you haven't seen smaller groups become contenders is because the larger groups make sure they don't gain a foothold, make sure they can't build Supers and Titans. They won't even sell them outside of their coalitions.
Yeah, but the only thing is, under this new system, the relevance of Supers and Titans, as they currently exist, scales down massively. Because let's say you bring in the big Super and Titan fleet, you take that point, your opponent drops shit, stands and bobbles, and leaves. That's it. They're gone. They're going to another point. I mean, why stick around? They don't have to be there to defend that point anymore.
Exactly.
And your fleet is now out of place and mispositioned. That's the thing. That's why, arguably, as it currently stands, the Supers currently stand, you could argue that they're going to be effectively useless in this new system. I mean, you can't use them to take points. I mean, we did some number crunching. It's going to take 3 hours for a Super to cap one of these nodes if they've got full defensive buffs. Where's the use in that?
I mean, you could argue they still make for an outstanding escalation force, but the fact of the matter
certainly
remains that the Finger of God is way too slow to make an effective defense now.
There are thousands of Super and Titan pilots who sit unsubscribed if they don't put something in the game that makes those ships useful. I think CCP would be insane if they don't figure out a way to make those ships want to be logged in and want to be subscribed.
Most certainly, but that of course is why we're going to be looking into a rebalance change to how these ships play. It's going to probably become much more likely that the role of Supers and Titans and so forth is going to shift from being the hammer where everything is unnailed to being a much more of a command structure, a ship that arrives and supports the fleet rather than arrives and just kills everything.
And
I think that's really the long-term goal.
The ship arriving is going to be the key point. I mean, whatever way they're rebalanced, they're not going to be rebalanced to be nano ships all of a sudden. So they're things that you can move around with, and especially with the Phoebe jump changes, you know, there could be significant windows where you actually have time to take space away from the Titan just because you've moved around it. If it's 3 jumps away, depending on the geography of your constellation, that thing's not moving 3 jumps in 10, 15 minutes by gates. And you know, it might have a jump timer if you make it jump to the 3-jump spot and then you go 3 jumps back to your original position. So you can, you know, depending on the geography of the constellation, there's now room to work around these things. Now, of course, certain coalitions will have enough Titans to put a Titan in every single, you know, area of space. Sure.
But that just isolates the Titans.
Well, you presume they would have support fleets, too. I mean, there's no getting around that large, organized groups of players are going to be difficult to fight. I don't think any change to the game is going to you know, alter that underlying basic fact. But the playing field is a lot more level, and there's a lot more room for counterplay now if the smaller force has their stuff together.
Okay, we're going to move on to the next question now. Next question is, who do the proposed changes benefit most? Sovholders versus non-sovholders who operate in Null. And we're going to go in reverse order this time. So, Shadow and Light, you first on this one.
I think the groups that have learned to diversify themselves outside sovereignty will be in a stronger position if they aren't huge. I think PL did a smart thing. They usually are ahead of the curve, and I don't think this is any different. They gave up all their sovereignty. They have decided they're going to live in LOSAC and MPC space. We'll see if they made the right decision based upon if CCP turns sovereignty into something lucrative, which right now you could argue that really the only lucrative part of sovereignty is either renting or owning moons. And they still own a lot of moons, R64s and R32s, so I don't think they're hurting in that regard. But we will see. I think the groups that have learned to remove that crutch, which I think sovereignty to small to medium-sized groups is a crutch. I think when groups learn to remove that, I think they'll be in a stronger position. The question is, will the sovereignty mechanics coming to us, which we don't really have any full grasp on what the new sov structures will look like and what their benefits will be, will not owning those put the medium and smaller groups who aren't huge coalitions in a bind because they're missing out on some very key or very lucrative part of the new sov?
Okay, next is Connell Tara.
It's a tricky question, because we're still to find out a lot of what CCP is going to do to sort of, for lack of a better term, compensate the existing null entities for what this additional, you know, turmoil, wrong word again, is going to cause. Short term, the big winners are the non-sov holders, for the one big reason: you can now force people to fight you. As a wormholder, one of the most frustrating things that can ever happen is you arrive in system and everyone's paused up. That's it. Nothing's going to happen. You're in the intel channels, there's going to be no targets, and there's pretty much nothing you can reliably do to get them to come out and fight you. This new system, they can force a fight. We can trigger a sov event if they don't bother to come out first. We can do some, even if it's minor, some material punishment for the people who aren't holding on, sort of aren't willing to fight us. In that respect, the non-sov holders are going to win because we've got more drivers for conflict. The sov holders themselves, arguably, the people who are willing to use their space, willing to fight for it, are going to benefit. They're going to get more content, there's going to be more activity, new combat systems are going to be more engaging to use. There's a lot of positive and negative. I mean, obviously we've got the upcoming question about the ore changes, which is part of it. But it'll be interesting to see how more things develop over time.
Okay, next up is Dirk McGurk.
You know, if you want the benefits of living in Null, you know, and the community kind of stuff that surrounds it, I don't think a lot changes, you know, within this new mechanism. But if I had to sit there and weigh who do I think is going to have more fun with the mechanic, I think it is going to be those non-sov holders who operate in Null, because they don't have to watch their backs. They don't have to worry about, while I'm out here trying to do this to so-and-so, somebody else is coming in my back door and attacking my things. Whereas the people that live in Null are going to have to, you know, constantly be on the lookout for, you know, somebody coming by and trying to take something away from them. I mean, you know, as he said, you know, basically I think you will be able to get fights, force fights out of people, force a response out of them, because they live in Null and have something to lose. Whereas the people who want to encroach, whether it be from wormholes or whether it be from Emamaki, NPC 00, they don't have that sense of threat to their own holdings, because those are protected by empires, or they're protected by, you know, a wormhole entrance or what have you.
Okay, next up, Lockfox.
Yeah, I'm going to echo Dirk here that it's going to stay reasonably same. I agree that a lot of the people who don't currently hold Sov have a reason to get into the fight. A lot of the smaller entities can start making trouble on scales that were completely locked out to them before. I also want to sort of point out that a lot of the shakedown is going to also rely on new structure mechanics that are still in flux. Just holding Sov, planting a flag is one thing, but threatening stations and dealing with posses are going to add a new depth to the field that I think are all going to independently change this with far broader strokes than just this Entosis change.
Okay, Alex from Declarations of War.
I think it probably is a boon to players that don't have Sov yet. I think defending out of a new system is going to be more difficult than before, and attacking is going to be a bit easier. Again, assuming there's some kind of nod given to the time zone shift. So, I mean, as a group that operates in 0-0 without Sov, I'm very excited at the opportunities for coordinated motherfuckery that this affords me.
Okay, and finally on this part, Kyle from Metani.com.
I'm actually going to have to echo a lot of what Alex just said, and Dirk and Lockfox both have some very interesting points that they bring up about this, but I think that one of the things that we're possibly slightly missing is that it's less about a buff of... less about a buff to Sov holders or non-Sov holders, and more of a buff to attackers versus defenders. And in this case, the attackers, who so commonly happen to reside in 0-0, are the ones receiving the buff, whereas the defenders no longer have the extraordinarily great advantage that they used to have.
Okay, and with that, we'll open this one up to a 5-minute discussion on the main question, which was, I'll just reiterate, who do the proposed changes benefit most, Sov holders versus non-Sov holders who operate in null?
What's going to interest me is any more word that they come out with regarding NPC 0-0. Because one would think that one way for even... sovereignty holders to react to this is, well, if you've got a local enough NPC 0-0, you could theoretically hoard forces, equipment in, you know, in some sort of NPC area, you know, rather than have, you know, Fortress, whatever, Fortress Yao or Fortress VFK or, you know, wherever, right? That could ultimately be taken. Now, you know, I'm not saying that VFK can be taken because VFK by whenever, but, are they going to do anything that says, look, these are not just complete and utter safe grounds while everything else has this, you know, has this element of much more risk involved with it going forward.
Well, that's why I miss the old, capital system from years and years ago. You couldn't just go in and headshot a system. You had to establish a beachhead. And I wish in some respects that comes back in some form or another.
Well, and I want to touch on Kyle's attackers defenders thing again, because that's actually another excellent point. We've seen in a lot of systems across EVE where we talk about, oh, an attacker is twice as likely to succeed as a defender or whatever. So to walk back a few years with the suicide ganking or faction warfare loyalty point payouts, like to really try and, yeah, the bar is now going to move towards in favor of attackers, but we're talking about a slight advantage for attackers over a major thing. And I also want to touch on Ashtarothi has liked to say on the Hydrostatic podcast that he wants these null capitals to feel like capitals, that when you go to VFK or whatever, that you really feel like you're in the heart of things. And yeah, I don't want people to just be able to go Hun Raider through whatever random point on the map they want. I want defenders to have space to grind through at some level, and attackers to still have efficacy. So again, I'm not in a lot of the strategy for the on the ground stuff so much, but I do like the direction we're moving.
It seems interesting to me because it seems almost as if they've tried to implement a little bit of the whole concept of the capital system again through the use of the occupancy mechanics. Obviously, one's capital system is going to be one of the most heavily bonus systems, at least in all likelihood, and will therefore take longer to grind through. And it's certainly a step in the right direction, but especially with these new structures coming out come this autumn, there's a lot of ground yet to cover.
I think that's a bit of a misnomer, because the old capital system involved making that capital completely invulnerable to attack, and all structures in it invulnerable to attack. That's why there is so much super capital proliferation under that old system. Now, you might have systems where people base out of, like, unofficial capitals, but I don't think anything that Fozzy has proposed is going to involve making systems completely invulnerable.
No, not completely invulnerable, to be certain.
No, but you're going to end up with places and systems which are going to be significantly more difficult to attack. I mean, one of the things that we should remember is that defenders are going to have a really significant advantage when it comes to these timers. I mean, the difference between you taking 10 minutes and them taking 40 minutes is going to help. I mean, obviously that's a perfect situation where you've built up the thing, and for new people, you're not going to have that level of strength to hold your systems with, but it is going to create these buffers of space which are significantly harder to crack, particularly if the defenders are willing to man up and really contest those timers. I mean, it's very much a shift in favor of the attacker, but it's not entirely one way. I mean, go on.
Well, and just to walk it back to the invulnerable thing, I would never really want anything to be invulnerable. Everything should be destroyed, burn everything. But the point should be that if you are a goon and you are sitting in VFK, that you shouldn't have to be swatting away flies every 15 minutes to hold that system. You'd expect that if there was an actual threat, that it would come at the periphery, that you'd be seeing it further out on the map, and you'd be more insulated by defense. Now, in functionality, if somebody starts kicking the hornet's nest, you undock a dozen people, you go blow them up, you dock back up. But it's like with POCO alerts, at least for my corp, that they just become such a frickin' chore that's like, oh, another attack. That's great. Do you guys actually want it, or are you just trying to get a fight? Because this is getting really obnoxious.
I mean, you know, as far as the capital system goes, I mean, I do miss that, because there was a logic to it that basically said, look, you're not just going to go and headshot this. You're going to have to work your way in, and that will not become vulnerable until you've, you know, done these things. I mean, we've used the analogy before that, you know, we didn't just land troops in Berlin during World War II, right? I mean, you know, you had to come in through the beachhead, and you had to work your way inwards. That is something that I think is still, to some extent, missing, from this these days.
Okay, we will move on to the next question, which is, given the proposed changes to mining, will NullSec actually become more self-sufficient? Should it be more self-sufficient? And will self-sufficiency create more conflict? Again, we're going in reverse order for this one, so Shadow and Light, take it away.
I hold the position that I think all space in EVE should have a symbiotic relationship between each system in each region. I don't like the idea that you can build everything you need to build inside of one region or even one part of space. You could maybe win me over if you said you would need to trade between 0-0, you would need to trade between low secs. But right now, the flow of the economy goes from high sec to 0-0 and reverse for some items. Low sec has some items that are only available in low sec, and I think that should be strengthened upon, not not turned around and said, well, we want you to be able to, we're going to force you to produce everything you need to produce inside of 00, the push to remove jump freighters. So the counter-argument has been made that it would be beneficial if you had to have a logistics chain that had to keep up with your advancement, your offensive or defensive measures. And I find some credence in that, but I don't feel like the economy should be pushed to the point where HiSec is completely independent of 00 and vice versa. You would lose a lot of the reasons people move between these areas to explore different parts of the game and to corner a market, so to speak, in one particular item that they want to go after. I think removing that link between these regions and these various HiSec, LoSec, and 00 regions would be a bad idea.
Okay, up next, Colonel Tara.
Right. Will NoSec become more self-sufficient? There's credence for that. I mean, talking to guys who do stuff in NoSec when it comes to mining and so forth, they're looking pretty optimistic. But should NoSec be self-sufficient straight up? No. No, not at all. The moment you create a situation where you can do everything yourself, you create walls, you create barriers, you isolate things. And one of the great things about EVE is that flow and movement of people going from wherever to whenever. If you have everything in one place, you make the game smaller, which was arguably one of the big problems with jumping before Phoebe. EVE was too small. It was too easy to just get everywhere for everything you needed. You wanted to fight on the other side of EVE? Yeah, that was fine. Phoebe made EVE bigger, and by keeping... In order for EVE to feel big, you have to have people moving. And I think creating self-sufficiency in any respect is going to be negative in that respect. Should the balance be shifted... Yes, right now we've got the problem where just too much is anchored into HiSec. When it comes to production, when it comes to invention, comes to research, comes to all the markets, there's a serious argument to be made for shifting that balance a little bit outwards so Null can do more, so industrials have more to do, but not to make them 100% independent of Empire Space. That would have negative consequences, I think.
Okay, moving on to Dirk from EVE Radio.
Yeah, let me start by saying I hope that they don't, begin to target anything that gets, so close to full self-sufficiency. More, absolutely, because I don't think that NullSec really has what it needs in order to be even remotely self-sufficient at this point. But complete self-sufficiency, I hope they really stay away from that. And I'm not just talking about minerals here, but. Since the focus recently has been on these, proposed changes to ore and Megasite and Vidrian and all that kind of stuff, it seems that they're really targeting the mineral aspect of things. I mean, these are the base building blocks of production. And I just don't believe that you should have that. I mean, I am somebody who believes in kind of a global economic approach, that there is a need for commerce, that there are places that are plentiful with, certain things and then other, other things, it could be downright scarcity of those things. I just don't think that, that any area, even on a regional level, should have all of the things that they need. That being said, I don't think that the changes to mining are going to be enough to really change things to being self-sufficient. It will be additive, but I don't think that it's going to change it in some gargantuan way, even to the point of whether or not they can truly shift things like jump freighters down to this 5 light-year range that I think is their target. I don't think that we ever get to the point where we're pulling in enough to be able to feed the production that takes place just to keep NullSec an active NullSec anyways, supplied. So I think that there is still going to have to be that connection to HiSec. I would much rather see it be where HiSec acts as kind of a clearinghouse for things coming from all over the place. You will see, because I think they're trying to balance two different things here. They're trying to balance, well, we don't want people moving around as much because of that whole force projection idea, along with, well, if we want to do that, then we have to end up giving them more stuff out there.
Okay, Lockfox from the EVE Prosper Market Show.
So this one has been my least favorite change, that self-sufficiency is a four-letter word when it comes to an MMO. I know that we want to talk at an organizational level of being self-sufficient, that it's a charming idea to live on the frontier and build everything on your own backs, and like a peacetime null capital. It's a charming idea to think of that as self-sufficient, to just keep the base load going and keep it running. And then, but the second you go to war, you have to go back to Jita. I know everybody hates the fact that Jita is the number one place, and that even the secondary hubs don't even come close to the amount of volume that Jita does. And I know that we want less Jita, but it comes down that you kind of need to pass through things to get them out there. Like, you say you want more Tech 2 production in NullSec, well, but you have to collect all of the moon resources in a central place, and whether that's VFK or Jita, I mean, it ends up being Jita, because then HiSec can process it, turn it into new things, and then it's easier to move the final product around than it is to move the sub part. Now, if you want to go, if the game designers really want to go at it and cut out the bleeding heart of the choke point, which is freight, the thing you guys keep touching on, then that's its own change. But to just be like, oh, well, we'll change the mining equations and now you can just get all the minerals you need and that'll be fine and dandy, it makes me cringe a little bit. I have some hopes for it, but I worry about the end impact.
Okay, Alex from Declarations of War.
I don't think 00 should be entirely self-sufficient. Obviously, trade and commerce should be an important part of EVE Online, and no one should be able to produce everything by themselves because it is an MMO. But at the same time, you know, no one in the real world is like, if you think about nations, we trade still. We have things that we're better at. We have more resources than others. Oil, lots of wood in one place. But there's few places with absolutely no food or absolutely no trees or absolutely no water. So I think the basic essentials, like for instance in EVE, it would be Tech 1 ships, should probably be able to be produced in non-wartime amounts just fine. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think if you do need to scale up for war production, yeah, maybe you need to reach out there and get things in larger volume. For Tech 2, maybe you're able to produce a certain race's Tech 2 ships in your 00 area with all the minerals and stuff that are in that particular region. But if you want a different race's ships, maybe you have to go to Jita to trade or have some other kind of arrangement. I think having to rely on Jita for literally everything, including the basics of in-game activity, is a big weakness of the game, and hauling things is not, generally speaking, not that fun. To be able to mine the essentials for, like, just replacement battle cruisers or whatever, I think that's just fine, and I'm glad that CCP is making that change.
Okay, and to finish out this part of the section is Carl from Atani.com.
I'm going to have to again echo a lot of what Alex is saying, with the basic caveat here that right now it seems that, at least in large part, all but the most heavily industrialized locations in NullSec are dependent on one-way commerce from HiSec. That is to say, NullSec players take the riskies, they go to Jita, they buy things, they bring them back to NullSec. What I'd like to see is a little less dependency on Jita and a little more interdependency, and I think that these changes help to foster that to a certain extent, without making NullSec entirely self-sufficient.
Okay, we'll open this up for the moderated 5-minute discussion. Just to reiterate the question again, given the proposed changes to mining, will NullSec actually become more self-sufficient? Should it be more self-sufficient, or will self-sufficiency create more conflict?
You know, this isn't a direct tie-in, but one of the things that I've always wondered why doesn't exist is why aren't people allowed to just press a button buy everything from the market and finish it up and get out in space. And I think this leads me to the question of why would they want to have regions who are completely self-sufficient, or they're pushing for self-sufficiency inside regions. My qualifier would be, if I was a pretend game designer for the day, would this lead to more people out there doing activities or less people? And if the answer is more people, then I suppose it's not going to be a bad change. But if the answer is less people, because maybe some of the activities they'll have to do in the future just isn't that enticing, like mining, will those people go out and do this now that we're pushing for inter-regional dependency and not allowing you to ship stuff from JITA anymore? That's my question.
Well, I mean, there's nothing that's, you know, the number one, I mean, they're saying more self-sufficiency. So I just hope that they've got, you know, some sort of limiting factor on that. There's nothing stopping anybody, even if they were to, you know, institute the jump crater changes to get them in line with all of the shifts, you know, tomorrow. There's nothing stopping anybody from, you know, ultimately getting there, I guess. I mean, there are some regions that it'll make it damn near, like, miserable to do it. But I really just sit there and wonder, because one of the questions that, you know, we kind of all talked about the self-sufficiency standpoint of things, but really the conflict driver in it, I'm just not sure. I'm not sure that, you know, I mean, might it put some more miners out in belts? Sure, but I don't look at that as being conflict.
Well, and going back to Shadow's point, as far as putting more people out in space, after I did a short time in the CFC, and I know, for instance, that when it comes to the sort of people you want in your coalition, you want 10 people with guns and maybe one miner or one producer when it comes to hiring people. You don't really care about builders, because they may do it, they'll figure out a way, but what you really need are monkeys with guns who will get in fleet and kill the other guy. And as much as this becomes more enticing, I don't see the big organizations going, oh, well, now we're going to institute that we want you to mine more. We're going to let you out of some amount of CTAs, or we're going to call less CTAs and have more mining fleets. I worry about that in the bigger thing about this, because it might be a more opportunity, but I don't know if it's going to get leveraged.
Okay, if nobody else has got any more on that, we will move on to the next question, which is question number 5. What do you see the future for supercapitals? And for this time, we're going to go in the standard straight order we do at the start of the show. So Kyle from Atani.com.
We touched on this a lot in the questions about the soft mechanics earlier, and I stand by what I said then. Primarily that in the current paradigm changes that we're seeing with the removal of almost every form of EHP grinding from the game, exempting pauses for now, of course. Supercapitals are going to be limited to little more than an escalation force. That is to say, they can be dropped on dreads or triage carriers to kill them should a fight escalate. Although that is certainly an important tool in its own right in any SC or Sky Marshal's lockbox, I think there's going to need to be some sort of paradigm shift to keep them, while not the finger of God of Saw Warfare that they are now, keep them still relevant. On a purely personal level, I would like to see them used as sort of the mother of all command ships in some form or another, maybe making use of CCP's past proof of concept that they can create local buff effects, such as in wormholes. Honestly, not entirely sure how they would implement something like that, but it's an interesting concept.
Okay, next up, Alex from Declarations of War.
Skip me.
Okay, skipping Alex at his request.
Sorry, real life thing, one second.
Okay, well, we'll come back to you at the end then. Next up then, Locke Fox from Eve Prosper Market Show.
So this is a point that if you were watching a lot of the FanFest streams, CCP sees the issue. Like, since we've gone from an HP system to a time system, we don't need the amount of HP on grid that supercapitals have become the answer for. And I think CCP sees that. I would like to see some sort of role-based thing. Like, you can still see the value of Titans going forward, because they're a pocket gate for you, and you can use it as a force projection thing. But you go and you look at your super carriers, and you're like, yeah, I guess they do a lot of damage, but how many times are we really going to see capital escalations that need them? So I'm hopeful for some sort of grand role thing. I'm a little worried about it being another command ship sort of answer, but maybe some other service that is needed as a force multiplier is sort of what I'd like to see.
Okay, next up, Dirk from EVE Radio.
Yeah, I mean, this has really been something that's kind of been, you know, plaguing my brain since I own several of these things. I look at it and I sit there and say, obviously, this particular mechanic takes them out in anything other than escalation type of situation, more than likely. I look at conflicting statements from CCP, whether it be Fozzy down at EVE, on the EVE Down Under podcast, you know, or then Seagull at FanFest, kind of saying divergent things. Fozzy's was much more, well, Seagull's was much more in line with we want to make players want to use these things. Fozzy's thing seemed a little bit more, geez, I see the niche you're trying to put them in, but there's a lot of damn super capitals and a lot of pilots out there, a lot of players who have, you know, who have these things. And with that, you know, making them too niche, does it put it into where, well, you know what, I'd rather just log this guy out. He, you know, there's just no point in him, you know, if it's going to be that niche. I'm just not going to be around for those little niche occasions, you know, and they're not going to need as many of us. So I think they have a very difficult road to kind of, you know, balance the fact that players want to have bigger, more expensive things. This, I don't want to call it end game, but certainly progression. And then, you know, the fact of, well, we kind of want to do, it seems as though we kind of want to do away with this, you know, call it I win button of just put, you know, 200 of these things on grid and call it a day.
Okay, Alex back, so we'll move to Alec from Declarations of War.
Yeah, great. Sorry about that earlier. I think the supers will have an interesting role. I think a general capital rebalance will probably shed a lot of light on that. The direction they choose to go with carriers, which are right now straddling a fence, they're both DPS and logistics. They're probably going to have one of those specialized. I'm hoping it's the logistics aspect, because we already have dreads for DPS. So we'll have carriers for Logi, dreads to break the carriers. Maybe we'll have super carriers to break the dreads. Presumably Titans will have some kind of roll bonus, which will enable breaking super carriers easier, but may lose some of their offensive capabilities. Or maybe that's not what's going to happen. I don't know. But I think the direction that the larger capital ecosystem takes is going to tell us a lot about what supers and Titans are going to wind up doing at the end of it. I don't think we're going to need them in exactly their current form under the new system, but I do think they're going to have some, they're going to have something compelling about their gameplay which says to a pilot that's in that ship, yes, I want to be on grid, I want to be actively paying attention to my EVE client. I don't want to be sitting at a POS with a command ship, you know, otherwise I'd sit at a POS with a command ship. I'm in a big, bad, end-game content ship. I want to get on field and have a major impact. And I don't think that fundamentally is going to change. I don't think CCP would do that. They'll probably take it in a different direction than it is now. But I think they're going to want to still have that interesting, compelling, you know, when someone drops a Titan or a bunch of super carriers, you know, you're like, oh man, this is awesome, or this is a big problem, we have to deal with this. I don't think they're going to be something you can just ignore. I don't think they're going to be something you just set at a pause and use.
Okay, we'll move on to Connell from Fly Reckless.
The eternal problem when it comes to super carriers and Titans, we all know, is it's always been the N plus one thing. There's so goddamn many of the things that the only real way to counter them is to bring more of the things. And if we're going to see these ships survive in this new system, I think it's going to have to be something quite drastic. Something that's really going to alter how these ships actually operate. Are they simply just a bigger ship with bigger guns, with more firepower, more health? Or do we want them to become something much more interesting? I mean, guys mentioned earlier, we're talking about they project wormhole effects onto the battlefield. They change the gameplay some way. And I think that's something that we really need to consider where we need to go. I mean, random spitballing examples. A Titan lands on grid. What does Titan do? It sets up a pulse bubble around itself. It's now a bastion point that people can use for coming back, repping, resupplying, then moving back out again. Supercarrier lands on grid. What does it do? It provides additional ships for people. It provides large-scale repair facilities, stuff like that. But move them into a more logistics support role rather than being, you know, the end-all beatstick. And it's going to be interesting to see how CCP looks at that and where they take these ships and how useful they're going to be while maintaining that simply having more of them doesn't let you win. Because at the end of the day, having more bodies is going to be an inevitable advantage in any situation. Having more bodies and better ships shouldn't just be an instant win. There should be some elements of strategy and gameplay and composition. And hopefully CCP will find some way to make that work.
Okay, and finally for this question, Shadow and Light from Legacy of a Capsuleer.
I think Connell has some interesting ideas. I agree with him. I've actually stated before that I think a role for Titans possibly could be mobile POSs that are set up in emergencies, but then are put in a position of vulnerability when they come out of maybe a reinforcement timer or some other mechanic. I think CCP needs to think outside of the box. And whatever they come up with, they need to make sure that they're able to reiterate on it very quickly. They cannot turn around and implement something that takes 4 years for them to readdress. Various ideas that I've had was maybe turning supers and titans and allowing some kind of point defense role, allowing capsuleers to jump inside of them and take control of turrets. There is already a VR demo that CCP showed at FanFest of a turret-based VR simulator that was inside of, I think, of an Abaddon. So I think they might already have some idea for that sitting out there. I think Dreads need a serious look at. You don't see fleets of Dreads rolling around. You see fleets of Archons or fleets of Supers and Titans, but Dreads are kind of relegated to get them on field, hit a POS, and get them off before they get tackled because they're in a lot of trouble. If they do get tackled, I think Dreads really need some love, some attention, if you're going to look at capitals in total. And I think maybe industry roles for Supers and Titans, it should not be out of the equation if we're going to think outside the box. If you spend 100 or 150 billion on a Titan and you can't use it anymore for a pure offensive role and perhaps a defensive role is niche and you can only have so many of them for whatever they have in mind, maybe allowing them some kind of industry capability as well would be a good idea. Maybe they can be super producers or provide some other outside of the box thinking for these ships other than just letting go of the subscriber. I think there's a real danger that CCP doesn't get this right. They have an opportunity to lose a lot of paying customers who are going to turn these accounts off and not bring them back to the game.
Okay, we will now move to an open discussion on this topic. Just to reiterate the question, what do you see the future for super capitals?
Locke made a point, about Titans being a pocket bridge. Number one, I think that ever since really their inception, CCP has kind of gotten it wrong because they didn't. I don't know that they had the vision at the time for how far we would all go with building these things. I think they thought that they were going to be totally strategic assets, and we know that they're like pilot owned at this point in large numbers. But Locke made the point about Titans being a pocket bridge. To be honest, I'd rather see them lose that pocket bridge standpoint. I would rather see these ships, whether they be Titans or whether they be supercarriers, actually used to carry troops directly into the battle area, so that they don't just create a bridge and a sino and suddenly 250 spaceships appear. You want to get 250 ships there? Guess what? You're going to have the troop carriers that bring them in. And maybe that is something that these things could be used for.
Well, actually have them couple onto the larger motherships and then get carried through.
How difficult would it be to have, I don't know from a programmatic standpoint.
Pretty fucking difficult.
How difficult it would be to be able to have pilots basically dock in these things and be carried along rather than go through a jump bridge type mechanic.
Well, and that actually segues to a point I kind of wanted to come back to, was that whatever role we see supers take forward, we really want to see them put on the field. We want to see them have a legitimate use to why you'd want to risk them and a legitimate detriment that gives your opponent an opportunity to kill supers, death to supers.
We've all gone quiet for a moment there. Yeah, it's it's this real sort of thing. It's like, what we need them to do something else, but the idea of doing something else, there's really only so many things in EVE ships can do. I mean, when it comes to PvP, you can rep, you can jam, you can shoot, you can move. Finding something beyond that that isn't simply boosting is a little tricky, and especially it's going to have to come from something from the ground up in a lot of respects. I mean, the idea of having these ships deploy and apply something to the field is a really good idea. Move them into something that you fight around rather than simply fight with would be wonderful. The idea of having them as the delivery mechanism for ships, not just sending them off, but even coming along with them and then giving you have some defend as well. We're going to need something very, very different to keep them both relevant and interesting. And I'm very interested to see what CCP comes up with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the concept, the issue that they really deal with, is the fact of, number one, with so many out there, it would be nice if they can come up with an idea that uses them in a level that is kind of commensurate with how many are out there, but also in a way that doesn't devalue them to the point of, oh, geez, this ship is worth this. Is it worth putting it over there into that situation?
I think there is some logic to some reasoning for that, though, because I mean, one of the big problems, of course, we've had when it comes to the current system is that there is little to no reason not to throw your shit halfway across EVE, because you've got enough of it, you've not got a problem. There should be some thought that comes in. Is it worth deploying this level of assets to this level of fight? The spread out combat system that we're going into has some serious potential for helping with that. I mean, are you going to throw your 200-man capital fleet to take this one point? Well, you can, but you're going to be there a while, and you're not going to be achieving much while you're doing it. Will you split that fleet into five smaller fleets, for example, 40 guys apiece, and then send them out? That could work. But then you're putting at more risk to being attacked by larger counterattack blobs. You're going to need reserve forces. Are you willing to commit that while also willing to risk losing that? I mean, arguably, the thing CCP probably wants more than anything is to put these ships into a situation that gets them blown up. Reduce the numbers that way. Just make them worth risking and worth losing.
Oh, they could have fixed the issue of them being too proliferated a long time ago. I don't think that was their goal. I think they're concerned that they'll lose those accounts that stuck themselves in Supers and Titans and kept them logged in. That's why they didn't make them as vulnerable as they could have.
I think that's somewhat a more cynical way of looking at it, though. I mean, because arguably, the issue isn't that there is too many of them, let's be blunt. That is the current situation. There are too many of them. The game was never intended to have this many. But the fact that they're not dying in droves and then being replaced, that's a significant issue. It doesn't really matter if like stuff's constantly there. As long as it's dying, getting replaced, and being used, that makes a big difference, I think.
Okay.
One way they could have easily fixed the proliferation years ago was just have the cost of the ship scale with the economy of EVE. I think that was a huge mistake. I'm not saying it should have been an automatic increase in the cost of materials, but to have the price and the build value remain static while the numbers just kept exponentially getting larger was such a huge error.
Yeah, but the only problem with that is when you look at it, that only just makes the bar go further. As long as the ships aren't dying, the numbers are simply going to increase exponentially. That isn't a way of solving the problem. If the ships, for example, like required a constant supply of fuel and energy, like they actually cost maintenance, that would become into effect and become more relevant. But once the ship exists, it exists. Simply raising the cost just simply means people are going to grind longer for it. And well, time is the only commodity in EVE, and we've got tons of it to spare.
Yeah, and I mean, that would have ended up having a knock-on effect against everything. I mean, if you'd raised the build cost of these things, well, I guess you could have done it on the blueprint side, and it wouldn't have had as much of an issue. But certainly if you were trying to do it by way of mineral cost itself, I'm not sure that would have been the thing. But really where I think they messed up with it all was, again, it was so easy. Just so easy, whether it be through 425mm railguns or compressed ore now, to be able to get this stuff out to where they were being built, that really, just helped with the over-proliferation of them.
Oh, most certainly. But in the long term, it wouldn't have changed anything because, again, it's simply a matter of man hours.
Yeah. No, because, I mean, everybody went to him because they were the thing to go to. I mean, you know, even when the CFC, right, you know, who wasn't known for its massive capital force, you know, decided, oh, you know what, yep, we're going there too, and we're just going to go there with the numbers. You know, there used to be something in the game where you had a quantity versus quality effect, and that is something that to this day really is missing. That there isn't a kind of you know let's call it NATO versus Warsaw Pact mentality, right? You know, one side uses higher technology but lower numbers, and the other side uses more pitchforks and whatever. I mean, there isn't that offsetting choice.
No, I mean, the last time we really had that would have been right back when Goons and Bob were cracking heads, and that's a while back.
I still want to defend. I think there are some definite issues with some of the doctrines. I think Archons, for example, are way too powerful when used in mass, and maybe they're balanced individually, but when you get 100 of them together, they're pretty damn near impossible to kill, no matter how many people you have.
Almost certainly. That is the inevitable problem of N+1, and we can only hope that future balance changes are going to level that playing field a bit. I mean, it's all still on the cards.
But I want to defend that. You know, as Dirk was mentioning with a NATO versus Warsaw mentality, I want to defend that style of play to an extent, as much as I've had it used against me even. But the smaller groups should be able to maybe spend more money and use some better tactics coupled with better technology and be a major contender and not just be wiped away because you got zerged by, 5,000 players. I don't really enjoy that aspect either.
Oh, most certainly, but the problem right now is that the Zerg have the biggest ships. That's kind
right,
of the overriding
because there
issue.
Is no technology limitation.
Indeed. It is simply a matter of time, and that is the only true commodity within EVE.
I mean, every other game out there uses... Well, I can't say every other game. Many strategy games use player limits. You can't build more than X number of ships or bring it to a fight. You can't have more than X on the field. And I realize that we try to pretend that EVE Online is an MMO and a sandbox, but obviously the sandbox is broken when you start talking about the proliferation of some of these ships or the ability just to bring an unlimited amount of them onto the field.
I don't think it's terribly broken. If you bring an unlimited amount on the field and it doesn't help you do what you need to do. The reason why it works now is because of our hit point structure grinding system. You bring an unlimited number of Titans, and you're fine, because they do everything that you need. But the day that they can't do that, then you're not going to have the incentive to bring that many of them in one spot, and if you do, they're going to be terribly vulnerable.
Well, I disagree, because in the new system, if I bring 100 Archons and one high-strength buffered Tech 3, I just have to make sure that I cycle him in and out fast enough where he gets reps, or I bring a few, I bring some spares, but basically my entire fleet will be Archons, and I bring maybe a dozen other ships. I don't think we're solving some of these ship imbalances we're seeing just by going to this new soft system.
Well, no, but that's the thing. The only reason that system works is because you have that entire fleet in one place. Under the new solve system, you're going to have, was it at least 5 sites that you need to contest simultaneously in order to win? Yeah, you're going to win your one site every single time.
People.
Yeah, you're going to have your one site that you're going to win every single time. But you're going to lose the event because the guys with like 50 scepters have taken every other site. Well, that's a bad example of scepters, but they've got the smaller fleets, they've got the more mobile things. And because they're able to diversify, split up, and because they're encouraged to do so, there's more room for survival. The big hammer is going to be outmaneuvered, caught out of place, pinned in one system by more bubbling ships than God. And they're going to lose. I mean, they might not lose anything material, but they're going to have nothing for their effort, and they're going to be stuck in the arse end of nowhere.
Okay, I'm going to call time on that one. We have one final question, and it is the following. Overall, do you see the combined changes from Phoebe onwards creating a better, less stagnant Nullsec, or is it really up to us as players? We're going to go in the standard trait order for this, so Carl from Metani.com.
I'm not going to lie. I originally had a little bit of an opposition to this question, and it's for the very simple reason that while CCP can manipulate and adjust the mechanics all they want, it's really up to the players to actually do their thing. And we saw a huge example of this with Wormhole Space. Obviously, as many of us know and have been reminded of as recently as FanFest, CCP never intended for anyone to live in Wormholes long term. They intended for it to be a day trip event. players turn around and manage to figure out a way to live with them. And this has kind of told us over time that if the mechanics do not make it impossible, someone is going to find a way. So I think what CCP has done here is they've made it mechanically possible to level a playing field, and mechanically possible for a more dynamic and fluid Dalsec, but it's really up to the players to actually decide if that's what they want to pursue.
Okay, Alex from Declarations of War.
It's obviously going to come down to the players. CCP can only give us the tools. That said, I think we're giving a much better toolbox and a much better sandbox with this new system than we had before. And I'm excited to see how it shakes things up and how players will react to the new system and presumably lots of the balances that are coming with it. I think there's still some work CCP needs to do to give players compelling reasons to do certain things. Some of it's economics, some of it's structure related, giving us more ways to personalize the system and get emotionally invested in space. But I think we're finally on a strong foundation, which we haven't been for, God, how long? 5, 6, 7 years?
Okay, Lockfox from the Eve Prosper Market Show.
I think on the net, two things. One, I don't think CCP has a lot of room to make it much worse. If we had stayed on the Dominion path for the next 12, 18 months, I think that we'd be seeing the end of Eve in a bigger scale, just because it becomes untenable to really do the fights except from the N+1 supercarrier kind of thing. So I think that this gives a lot of opportunity for smaller groups to get in. I think this requires even the biggest players to sort of reshuffle their organizations into more active, less passive kind of activities in the game. And also, when it comes to like the Phoebe change, I think that that one's been a real net benefit overall, because it's now opened up the fleet space a lot more, especially for escalations to be a little more local, for operations to be a little more fluid. I know that we've seen it as an opportunity in LowSec, and I don't see why Null wouldn't also grab the opportunity. I think that capitals are going to need a little bit of love, but overall, I think the picture is moving in a positive direction.
Okay, and Dirk McGurk from EVE Radio.
Yeah, I'm always torn on this. Ultimately, I think it always comes down to we the players. But then in a lot of circumstances, it's not we the players as the masses. A lot of us, report to leaderships that make a lot of, the decisions as to kind of what things are done on a larger scale. But we the players, need to not be afraid to say, hey, let's not just sit around here, doing nothing. That we have got to use the tools that CCP gives us to play the game. Now, on the other hand, CCP needs to obviously give us tools that interest us. I mean, we are paying subscribers for a video game, and obviously they need to fix the things that don't seem to be working much faster than, let's say a couple years into stagnation. I think that this will lead to more conflict in the long run, simply because, again, as I said at the beginning, it's different. And I think that people will, seek to go after the challenge of what that difference does to the whole sovereignty mechanic. But remains to be seen what a year from now or 2 years from now, might necessarily bring. Overall, I'm optimistic though.
Okay, and Conal Tara from the Fly Reckless podcast.
Right, I'm going to get annoyingly metaphorical here. The way I sort of look at this is when people talk about history, there's two big schools of history. You've got great man history, and then you've got Marxist history. Great man history is the leaders, it's the battles, it's the pivotal events at the small level which then shape everything else. Marxist history is much more about the underlying currents, the things, the smaller things, the economic changes, all those little things which shift opinion and change how things work. The reason I'm saying this is the way to think about it is when it comes to the great man history, it's the players. It's the decisions we make at the small level, which spiral off into the butterfly effect that change everything. The impact that CCP has on the game, however, is very much best seen in terms of Marxist history. They aren't going to massively sweep changes. Nothing's going to go bang overnight. It's going to be up to us to be the catalyst that changes how everything works. The CCP can shift the strata, change the rules, encourage things to go certain directions, and it's in that respect where these changes are going to make the big difference. Guys are talking about a toolbox constantly. Right now, we're stuck with a hammer. It's a really, really good hammer, but there's so many other things that we could be using. Screwdrivers, mole grips, everything. All these other ideas and concepts which are going to just diversify and make this whole much, much stronger in the long run.
Okay, and finally for this part, Shadow and Light from Legacy of a Capsulea.
I do feel these changes are a step in the right direction. I hope that they continue to be responsive and on top of how the player base reacts. But I think as a development staff, as a company, they need to look harder at what drives players and build the game around that instead of trying to build the game around design that is much more rigid. You need to look at what motivates people to do things and then realize where this could head and be ready to change your direction sooner instead of waiting, as they have done in the past, a very long time to change directions. I think if you look at it from a more basic level of the human need, in our case, what they like to do, PvE, PvE, earn money, build their little empires, then you'll have an easier time understanding of where the chinks in the armor will be in terms of the game design.
Okay, now we will have a quick 5-minute open discussion on the question, which was, overall, do you see the combined changes from Phoebe onwards creating a better, less stagnant, or is it better or less stagnant NullSec, or is it really up to us as players?
I think it's pretty straightforward that we're all basically saying it's both. I mean, I don't think there's any disagreement there. We're not going to end up... I mean, CCP can't fix all of our problems. We can't fix all of our problems. It's going to have to be the combination of the two. Us willing to basically step out of our comfort zones and try the new stuff and see what works, see what sticks, give the feedback. I mean, we talk about CCP not seeing problems occurring and leaving things too long. But I think if we look at the last 2, maybe even 3 years, there's been a very big shift with how CCP's been doing things.
Yeah, with Siegel at the helm, I agree that CCP has taken a really different direction on actually designing different, implementing different, and releasing different, and I think it's generally more helpful, but until we actually see players engaging, population counts going up, things dying and being built, it's hard to really see the end game of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when it comes down to the players, sometimes I think that CCP as a developer, they've got to find the balance between not always playing into kind of the human side of things, because sometimes there's a bit of risk aversion that's built into, you know, most of our mentalities, even as far as the video game is concerned. And sometimes they need to try and kind of break that, even though it may not feel sandboxy to some people. You know, we have to remember that it's a video game, not some sort of world simulator, even though it's a pretty good world simulator.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's going to be the case that we're never going to have things perfect, in regardless of shape or form, and we really can't predict where things are going to go. I mean, at the very best, we can sit and cheer for what we like and boo down what we hate more than anything else. Overall, I'm looking forward to this, and I think we've got some real potential. I mean, more than we've had for a long time.
Yep, I agree.
Okay, with that, if nobody else got anything else for that, we will end with closing remarks from everyone, and we'll go down the line as well. So we'll start off with Kyle from thetiny.com.
I have to say, if we're looking at this from an overall sweeping brushstrokes perspective, the only thing I can really say is that I'm incredibly optimistic as to where these changes are taking us. I see essentially CCP attempting to do something pretty bold, attempting to listen to a lot of more player feedback than they may have in the past. I see them really attempting to give players a greater degree of agency over the space that they control. And to be honest, all of it looks pretty damn fun. Looking forward to this.
Next is Alec from Declarations of War.
Hey, I want to echo that sentiment. I'm very excited to get a crack at the new system. It's not going to be perfect, but I think if CCP has done nothing else over the past couple expansions, they really delivered on their willingness to adjust things that they've put out instead of leaving them sit for 5-6 years like they had been before. So even if it's not perfect, I think it's an excellent starting point. And it's very exciting to have something new in the game, especially something that takes dynamic off structures and puts it into something that's a bit more manageable for, you know, your game time. And it's going to unlock a lot of player energy, get people excited, get people fighting. And if it's not perfect, which it probably won't be, I have confidence that Fozzy will go back and, you know, make any tweaks that need to be made in a relatively manageable time frame.
And next up, Lockfox from the Eve Prosper Market Show.
I'm generally optimistic. I like a lot of the changes. I like how the vision for a lot of the operation for NullSec is going to move to have a lot more of a spectrum. We're not going to talk so much about the top end Apex Force. We're not going to talk all solely about frigate fleets. We're really going to have we have the opportunity for a lot more opportunities, I guess is the way to put it. I'm a little annoyed that it can't come soon enough, in my opinion. I've been a little weary about some of the stuff I've been watching through the markets and statistics over the last few months. So I'm really hoping that this lands with a big bang and we see a lot of activity come out the gate, because if not, things are going to get a little sticky. But I'm optimistic. I like all the changes. I think there's a lot of good energy behind it, and I'm excited to see the stuff finally start rolling out.
And Doug McGurk from Eve Radio.
Yep. First, I want to say that I'm sure that Mike Azariah will be quite pleased that nobody during the course of this entire 90-minute episode has used the term troll scepter. And I will put that at the feet of CCP for continuing as they have been for what I'll say is the good part of the last year, being open to discussion, being responsive to player discussions and thoughts. I think that this time, compared to the last time they changed sovereignty, there has been far more openness. This is a massive change that they are coming up with, and it's great that they have been dealing with it the way they have.
Okay, Connell from Fly Reckless Podcast.
It's hard to really say anything that I haven't already said this evening. The big thing really here is, I mean, we've been shouting for this for God knows how long. It's taking us a long time to get here. It's taking CCP a long time to get here. Would we have wanted this sooner? Oh, God, yes. If we had gotten it sooner, would it be what we've been looking at? Most likely not. I mean, Eve is the progressive game. It's the game that keeps moving forward, not necessarily in terms of getting better, but in the fact that there's time involved, and in almost no other game does that happen. Eve doesn't stand still. Even on a day where they aren't patching anything, things change. Attitudes, opinions, the big blocks, the small blocks, everything. And it's only because things have taken this long that we're where we are now. Is that good? Is that bad? It's impossible to say. We're only really going to be able to say with hindsight. But from what I can see, I'm really looking forward to this. Things are looking really, really interesting.
And closes out Shadow and Light from the Legacy of a Capsulia podcast.
Change is good. I'm happy they have took this seriously. I'm not going to sit here and say I'm ecstatic that these changes are going to fix issues. I think they bring up a lot more questions than they answer currently. But I'm excited that they're at least working on it. And my only hope is that they pay a close eye and don't abandon sovereignty down the road after they make these big sweeping changes to it and work on some other facet of the game. They need to keep a close eye on it like they do with many assets of the game. But I am excited. I think that this will be at least a huge monumental shift in the game. Maybe not fix issues, but it'll be interesting nonetheless.
Okay, well, that then concludes the second EVE Media Roundtable. I'd like to thank all the participants for coming in tonight. That's Carl from Mitani.com, Alex from Declarations of War, Lockfox from the EVE Prosper Market Show, Dirk McGurk from EVE Radio, Carmel Tara from the Fly Reckless Podcast, and Shadow and Light from the Legacy of a Capsuleo Podcast. I have been your moderator this evening. My name is Wiggles, and I'm also from EVE Radio.